I'd like to call the Senate Committee on General Government together. Want you to know that we're going to hold Senate Bill 150 over. So if you're here on that, it's going to happen on another day. I'd like to invite Senator Deckert to come up, and we're going to have a couple minutes on 511 at his convenience, and then we will return to Senate Bill 511 later this evening, probably. Okay?
At your wish, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
But I can have my two who come from at least a decent distance.
If they're part of your entourage, certainly, Senator, we wouldn't deny them the opportunity.
You know, it's no AOI entourage, but it's...
What? Can we close those back doors back there and kind of come to some semblance of order?
511.
Okay, Senator Deckert, I'm going to let Judith do a little bit of backgrounder on 511, and then it's all yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair Member. Senate Bill 511 changes the expenditures to be made from the electric utility public purpose charge monies. It eliminates expenditures for school district energy audits and implementation of audits, and increases low-income electric bill payment assistance. We have received a potential revenue impact statement on the measure. No word yet from fiscal. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Senator Deckert, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Ryan Deckert, State Senate District 14, which is Beaverton, or what's left of Beaverton, an unincorporated Washington County in southwest Portland.
That's a different bill. We aren't going there. Go ahead.
That's true. We went through that last night. Let me, if I could, set the table for this bill, because there will be, I think, a decent amount of interest in it, and it's something that really just emanated from, and maybe I'll begin there with an email that the person to my right sent, talking about the issue. And I served on the Board of Community Action, which is an agency in Washington County, but statewide, that really helps those Oregonians who are disenfranchised and low-income Oregonians. And I got an email talking about the low-income energy assistance program that I was obviously very familiar with. And really, and you will see on chart two that I provide for you, and I'd like to walk through that in just a moment, but really a dynamic that is taking place in the United States where incomes, and certainly here in Oregon, where incomes, as we know, in the last 5 or 6 years are down, and the chart illustrates that. Energy prices, as we are all well aware of, are dramatically up. And we know the federal administration right now is looking at cutting back on energy assistance to low-income individuals and low-income seniors in those tough, tough winter months. So, Mr. Chair, I started thinking about a real dramatic problem and came up with what I think is a creative solution to that problem, and it's embodied in Senate Bill 511. The reason I knew something about this is when we did Senate Bill 1149, 4 years ago, which restructured the energy distribution system, one of the provisions that was in the bill was actually an amendment that I had authored, and it took 15% of that 3% charge that's on all of our bills, or all of the investor-owned utilities bills, which is over half of Oregon, and that 3% goes to the Energy Trust, but we took 15% of that and we put it towards school audits. And it was an idea that Jim Hill, former Representative Hill, had, and I had, to really, because we were convinced that the audits that are done around the state, if you look at energy audits, they actually can be a built-in savings and a built-in funding for schools by giving them the information across the state of here are the projects that you can do within a school district. And so we chose the ISD as the best distribution point for those funds. But we wanted them to go out and do audits of every school district in the state to really provide those schools a listing of projects that they could do. I'm now pleased to report to you that those audits are now completed, are mostly completed. And so we have accomplished the goal that I had when authoring that amendment, which is to give them 15% and built in that funding measure for schools. now when I look at the landscape that Oregon faces, and my slide two, or the Oregon situation in my testimony, really illustrates, I think the compelling need, if I have to pick, in terms of that 15%, and I know I have hopefully a little insight into where that 15% came from, I look at the coming winters that are low-income citizens, and you're going to hear stories of from folks that know a lot more about this than I do. But to me, since the intention of the amendment 4 years ago was really to give them a listing of the audits and allow them then to start going about implementing that, I look at the compelling need. And so this bill is very simple. It's very straightforward. It takes that 15% and it says we are now going to redirect that to what was originally in Senate Bill 1149, which would be low-income energy assistance. That the monies that would be accumulated would do incredible good, and there is no waste at all, because these goes right to the utility companies for bill payment, so that is a streamlined, efficient delivery system, and it manifests itself in a warm house for kids and for seniors and for citizens that otherwise are going without. And so to me it is a natural, it is a good fit, and if I could just hit a couple few things in the background, then I'll hand it over and appreciate your taking the time, Mr. Chair. Nearly all of the energy assistance funding that was available at the start of the heating season was gone by January of this year, or already committed. So we had a warm, although a somewhat warm, but all of the monies that we had available were gone in January. You take that and you think of last year. And the implications of no energy money available to our citizens after January. There were over 10,000 low-income households that had appointments with local agencies through March 2005 just to see, 10,000 Oregonians, just to see if they had qualified for energy assistance, just checking, which was news to me and certainly shows you the incredible need that is going unfulfilled out there. Over 15,000 households are on a waiting list for assistance that most will likely never receive. And we think this number is significantly understated, since not all agencies actually keep a waiting list. Further evidence that there are just thousands and thousands of Oregonians that are having to go through these winters without energy. And Mr. Chair, every day 1,500 people in Oregon call their local community action agency seeking energy assistance. The vast majority of these people either have a shutoff notice or are currently disconnected from utility service. Most will receive no help. So, Mr. Chair, we think we bring you a solution to this problem, one that that I think really meets the test of solving a problem, but also having provided two goods. And with that, I'd like to hand it over to Geraldine Ness, the Director of Community Action in Washington County, who prompted me with a email that she sends out, and to another board member in Washington County who's actually a citizen who has had an experience with this.
Senator Deckard, I want you to hold right there while they do their testimony, but I want to announce to everybody that's here, I had made a promise to the senator that I would start at 3 o'clock with him. We're going to go briefly on Senate Bill 511, and then I'm going to go to the lottery bill that's in front of the committee, and then on to a couple other very brief bills before we get to the SAFE issue, which is the other big issue in front of us. All three of these issues are important issues to different constituencies. In some senses, a lot of them hit the same class of people in need. So I want to thank you for bringing it. I just want you to know the timelines that we're working within this afternoon. And your name again?
My name is Geraldine Ness, and as Senator Deckard said, I'm the Executive Director of Community Action in Washington County, where I have worked for the past 32 years. Our statewide network of 18 community action organizations is the group that's responsible for providing low-income energy assistance to thousands of Oregonians annually who are struggling to make ends meet. Our network also provides a range of other anti-poverty services, such as emergency shelter and food, child care and Head Start, and self-sufficiency services, to name a few. I want to start off by first thanking Senator Deckard for raising this critically important issue. We know across Oregon the need for energy assistance has been unprecedented this past year, and every request for help that we receive represents a family's heart-wrenching story of hardship and struggle. The need has grown due to a combination of factors of energy and housing cost increases, high un- and under underemployment and significant cuts to other safety net services that families have depended upon. The need has far outpaced Community Action's ability to respond. We have long lines that are forming for help around our buildings, our phone lines are jammed, and our waiting lists continue to grow. As a member of my board of directors, Senator Deckert knows firsthand the economic insecurity that exists even in the wealthiest county of our state. His responsiveness to the needs of our community is exemplary, as is his commitment to keep seniors, the disabled, children, and families with heat and electricity. I want to talk a bit about the details of the program, how it's run, and who receives assistance for a moment. The Public Utility Commission sets a collection rate, or a meter charge, for customers of the investor-owned utilities. This shows up as part of their monthly bill. Effective tomorrow, this charge for residential customers will be 33 cents per meter per month. Businesses pay a separate rate not to exceed $500 per site per month. Oregon Housing and Community Services receive the funds and then distribute them to eligible community action agencies. We in Washington County are responsible for determining which households are eligible and granting assistance by making payments directly to the utility vendors on their behalf. We keep our administrative costs very low, and we ensure that the public we serve are served with dignity and respect. Unlike some other assistance programs, senior citizens, families, and individuals will only receive one payment per year. However, that $100 to $200 payment can make a difference during the colder months between keeping the heat on or not. And it is estimated that every day 1,500 people contact their local community action agency seeking energy assistance. But because of lack of funds, many do not receive help, and we know that statewide only about 20% of the eligible low-income households receive energy assistance. In Washington County, we're able to serve over 7,000 low-income households annually, but we know that for every household we're serving, we are turning away four or five other households because of lack of funds. Also, in our community, we are working very closely with community partners to let those in the most need know of the help that we can provide. And seniors and people with disabilities receive special outreach for our funds. Many are served through a direct mailing of applications. And senior centers around Washington County, outreach workers help by making home visits when needed and referring people to us. Many other social service programs do outreach and intake for eligible clients and send their applications to us to process the payment. So because of this highly collaborative service model, we are able to reach the maximum number of people while still keeping our costs very low. And I'd like to just take a moment before I pass it on to Dana to just give you an example of one family situation and to remind you that this is really just one example of thousands of personal stories that we hear every year. A young couple with three children had recently bought their first home in the Hillsborough area. He had worked in the trucking business for 9 years, and she was employed with the county. 6 months after buying the house, he got laid off, and her hours were cut. He was unemployed for 9 months, and they got behind in their bills. The family almost lost their house, and then he got a new job, but at 40% less pay. She decided to get a second job after their water was shut off, and they had to borrow the money from her parents to pay the bill. She worked sporadically due to some health problems she was having with her neck and back. When their daughter was diagnosed with diabetes, she had to leave her second job to be with her daughter, who was in and out of the hospital. Both their gas and electricity were turned off when they came to us. We were able to help them get both their power and their electricity back on. They've now sold their second car, will probably sell their house, and will move in with their parents until their child's health is stabilized. She will have surgery on her neck, and they hope to get back on their feet financially. just thousands of stories like this in our community in Washington County. We've distributed to you copies of a statewide report issued earlier this year as additional information about how low-income energy assistance operates in Oregon. So I want to thank you for this opportunity to share with you our local experience and introduce to you Dana Galaxy, whose family was served by our agency with energy assistance, and she also represents the low-income community on the Community Action Board of Directors.
Dana, I want to welcome you. I'd like to have you summarize your testimony in a few, two or three minutes, okay? Thank you. I appreciate you coming, though, I do.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Dana Galaxy, and I came to the United States from Czechoslovakia 15 years ago. I live in Aloha with my husband and three children. I have a 13-year-old son, Richard, 8-year-old daughter, Michelle, and a 5-year-old daughter, Elizabeth. Thank you for the opportunity to testify about the importance of low-income energy assistance. I want to tell you about how energy assistance program provided through Community Action helped my family for past 3 years with the high cost of heating and electricity. Because of our limited income, there is no way we can stay warm and afford to pay for high heating bills in the winter months. Our average energy bill in the winter is about $90, which is about 10% of our income. It is difficult sometimes for us to get by even in the summer months. We also have a wood-burning fireplace, which is we use during winter. The wood that we burn is a scrap wood, which we collect from the dumpster of the furniture manufacturing in the Hillsboro all summer long. Still, it is not enough. No fireplace is warm enough to heat a two-story house. No amount of sweaters replaces heat from radiators. And no amount of candles gives you enough light. You can say it's romantic, but there is no romance with a cold nose, freezing fingers, or even cold eyelids. And believe me, if you get very cold, even your eyelids get cold. You can survive like that for a little while, but live like that through whole winter, it's impossible. That's why I'm grateful that Community Action offers this great program during winter months. In addition with helping with our heating bills, Community Action also provides energy education group workshop, which I have taken a few times. They teach us about energy conservation, like how to lower our utility bills, how to stay warmer during cold winter months, and also how to be comfortable during the year. I come here as one, but stand here as thousands. There are many families in our community who can tell you similar stories, some even worse than mine. There are many people who need help during winter time. We are all grateful that there is a place with a wonderful, irreplaceable program where we can go and get help. Thank you very much for the opportunity to share my personal story.
Thank you very much. Given the amount of work this afternoon, I don't think we'll ask a lot of questions, but Senator Deckard, I'm going to reopen this hearing later in the evening. And return to the subject. Other people have signed up to testify on the bill. I think it's a very worthy bill. It's part of us not acting like a civilized society, which we don't do very much when we turn a deaf ear to those that are cold, hungry, etc. So with that, I'm going to, close it? Okay. Close or recess the hearing on Senate Bill 511, which we'll return to later in the day.
Okay.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you
very
much.
And I'm going to now open a work session on Senate Bill 498. And I'm going to ask Judith if she will tell us both about the bill itself and about a couple simple amendments to the bill. And then I have a few people that I'd like to invite up to testify on the bill, particularly from the governor's office. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair members. Senate Bill 498 limits compensation of video lottery game retailers to 15% of net receipts. We have received a potential revenue impact and a no fiscal impact on the original measure. The Dash 1 amendments that you have at your seat is changing the percentage from 15% to 20%. So in other words, on line 19 of the original bill, it will now read that a contract between the Oregon State Lottery and a video lottery game retailer may not provide for compensation to the video lottery game retailer that exceeds the Dash 1 amendment, say 20% of the video lottery game retailer's net receipts. The Dash 2 amendments would insert an 18% net proceed under those same circumstances. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Is Chris Warner in the room? There he is. She was hiding behind somebody. Yeah. Chris, I realize that the governor is involved in some very complicated situations right now relative to the line games and so on, but he sent a letter, as I understand it, yesterday. I'd kind of like you to share the letter with us and what's behind the scenes on the letter, and I'm going to ask Senator Verger and Senator George to bring any questions that they might have on the thing. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Chris Warner. I'm Governor Kulongoski's legislative director, and I'm pleased to be before you today. First off, I think, as the senator said, I'm not here to address specifically Senate Bill 498 or any of the amendments that Judith spoke of, but share with you the direction that the governor did give the Lottery Commission and the expectations for maximizing revenues for the many critical programs that lottery proceeds fund. As a bit of a background, I'd just like to say just a couple of words before I get into the text of the letter. When the governor unveiled his recommended budget in early December, there were many tough decisions he had to make. Certainly, tough decisions that everyone in this building will be making over the next for the coming weeks. And certainly one of the toughest was his direction to the Lottery Commission to take steps to expand the current games that they do, including line games, to fund these critical services that we all know about. As you know, the Commission has been deliberating these questions of rates of these new line games for a number of weeks, and on March 21st, the governor wrote a letter to the Commission, and with your permission, I'd like to quickly read that letter, if I might. The letter was addressed to Director Penn. First, I'd like to thank you and the members of the Commission for the in-depth and thorough approach you are taking in reviewing all of the issues involving the implementation of line games. I believe you have conducted yourself in an exemplary manner as charged by law to ensure that the Commission effectuates the purposes of the lottery and to take into account in all of its decisions the sensitive nature of the lottery. Because of this sensitivity regarding the implementation of line games and retailer commission rates, I'm sending this letter to reaffirm my position. I believe that my direction to begin negotiations for commission rates for line games at 15% was a right starting place for the discussion and analysis, and I expect you to conduct. As you know, I have repeatedly stressed the need to maximize revenues for the purposes of funding, of providing important services to Oregonians. I've also made it clear that there must be a reasonable rate of return that ensures the sustainability of our commercial partners. No commercial system can succeed, including the Oregon Lottery, nor can it provide sustainable growth without balancing both short-term gains and risks against the long-term stability. Again, I appreciate your efforts in this matter and know that you will do a thorough review of data and information to determine how to strike this important balance. As regards Governor Kulongoski. That was the letter he sent on the 21st, and as you are aware, these are very contentious issues with emotions on all sides running very high. As the governor has stated all along, we trust that the commission will look at all of the data and ensure that any new rates that are adopted will maximize revenues for all these important services to Oregonians. With that, I'd be willing to answer any questions and kind of begin the discussion if you'd like. So,
are there questions that you have, or shall I begin? Senator Verger.
Yes. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. In coming up with a percentage or what you've said, 15%, has there been any just spot checking of financial statements from businesses to determine what would be a fair return on investment? And rather than we're not just grabbing something out of the air, I presume.
Certainly. Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, that is part of the process that the Lottery Commission has been dealing with in terms of taking a look at the data. I think as one of the news articles said in the paper this morning, it's not necessarily a science in terms of how you put these rates together. So we are having them take a look at the data, and we are looking forward to that data as they are gathering it. As you know, Director Penn did make a recommendation yesterday, and I think the final recommendation will be made by the Commission next week. We are looking forward to taking that data, looking at it ourselves, and so the governor can make a determination in terms of kind of where he thinks this all comes down.
Follow-up, Mr.
Yes.
One of the comments, this is more of a statement if you'd like to respond, and that is that when the contract was first made, it was made on a basis of just not knowing what the future might bring. Would that be a true statement? The contract that of the percentage that they're getting now.
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, I would have to get back to you on that. I'm not sure exactly. I was thinking of this prospective contract in terms of the line games as opposed to the process we just went through with the re-up of, if you will, of the contract. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator George, do you have a question?
Go ahead. I'll follow you.
No, I'll let you go first. Go ahead,
right,
sir.
Thanks. I went back and was reviewing the Constitution last night. You know, that just shows you don't have a life. Looking at who had the authority on this issue, and I'm wondering how appropriate it is for us to even be discussing this. But my question is relative to the letter from the governor. And he talks to the commissioners, and he said that you've done an in-depth, a thorough, and you've reviewed all of these issues, and you've conducted yourself in an exemplary manner as charged by the law. And that's what I read. I see them as being the entity that is, in fact, responsible for this. And so my question for you is, why would we be passing a bill telling them what to do when the governor has such confidence in them?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I'm actually not here to speak about the bill, so that's certainly something for the committee to consider. I was asked to come here to talk about the commission process and the process that they went through and the governor's input into that. So I'm certain that the committee will be discussing that bill. So,
in fact, Senator George, I did point that out at the beginning. He's not here to discuss the bill. He's mm-hmm. here to give us some background on the lottery and where the governor has been
right.
in this negotiating process.
Okay. Can I have a follow-up? The governor also in the second to last paragraph makes a statement about recognizing that they have to have a reasonable return and we have to sustainable growth within that and balancing both short-term and long-term gain, relatively talking to when I read that about the interest of our providers out here. Now, I remember when the lottery was passed and its purpose was for economic development. And I know a lot of restaurateurs who are just suffering greatly trying to survive today. I mean, barely keeping their doors open. And I keep wondering about what impact do you believe, and I think the governor is kind of leaning this way, if we reduce the amount that they're going to be able to obtain, because obviously they're hiring, they're spending in our communities, in every community in the state.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I think that's part of the balancing act that that we are asking the Lottery Commission to undertake. And certainly one of the things that we've found during this administration is that these citizen commissions somehow get some very difficult tasks before them, and certainly the Lottery Commission is no different. And our hope is that they will be able to take all of the data and make this a data-driven process to take a look at the retailers, but also the real needs we have to maximize the revenue. So that's the balancing act that they are commissioned to do. And so we are, you know, hope to support them in terms of making sure that they take a look at all of those different factors.
Thank you. Earlier today, I was myself talking to Dale Penn, and I asked for some background, and he said, well, you know, the first thing that we're facing here is in the governor's budget they need $120 million. And so some core assumptions are that all the retailers are going to participate in the new games, that the forecast increase will be 22%, 10% due to economic turnaround, and 12% due to the new line games. The Lottery Commission thinks that in the next biennium, with a 24.8% proposal that they'll get $124.5 million. Well, that's a little more than the governor's budget. On the other hand, the Oregon Restaurant Association proposes that with 26.8%, they'll get $148 million for us in the next biennium. The Lottery Commission's model suggests that it won't be that high, that it'll be only $106 million, because, in fact, they're getting a higher percentage, and maybe the expansion won't be as much as the Restaurant Association thinks it'll be. I'm, however, interested in a third proposal that was brought forth by the Stand for Children of 21.3%. These are all compromises, of course, from the 15. And theirs is based on 85 of it being the old video and the rest of it being the new line games. And I can't remember whether it starts with 15 or 20%. But they are suggesting that as much as using the Lottery Commission's model that we could take in $178 million. Now, when you have that many different balls in the air, it's hard to tell what's going to fall where, mm-hmm. you know, all the way around. There's problems with that projection, since there are owners that would say, I'm not going to play for that. You know, we're not going to run our games for that. We're going to hold out for more, and so on and so forth. That's the landscape that you're looking at. That's the box that you're in the governor's office, in the Lottery Commission. Is there any way that you can bring some new information, some new dynamics to all of these positions that can break you out of what seems like a logjam where nobody's going to win? I mean, I'm thinking of it on the one side. The restaurant people are stuck at one end. School children are stuck at the other end. Senator George rightly said, you know, economic development's important. The other end, kids are important, and we have schools that are desperate. Are there any new pieces that are in the backs of your minds that could be brought to this equation that can break this logjam that you're thinking about?
Chair Shields, we are still working through it. As I said, we are waiting kind of to for our office to examine the data set and to try and find a logjam. But as you've said, this is not an easy subject, and it is going to be a very difficult decision. And I'm afraid it's one of those decisions. Whatever decision is made, someone is going to be unhappy, and we will certainly try to make the best decision that. The commission will make the best decision that it can, trying to weigh all of these different, very passionate competing interests. So it's going to be very difficult. I wish I had an answer for you, and we will continue to try and be creative and try to come up with something, you know, in the next week or so. But just know it's very difficult.
Let me ask you, please, to let the governor's office know that we're wanting to be of help. This is serious business. It's serious for the state. It's serious for our school children and so on. With that, I would like, if there's anybody from Stand for Children here, to ask them to come forward and to comment just briefly on this 21.3% proposal. Chris, I want to thank you for your time, and again, please let the governor know that we'll do what we can do to try to help.
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I only have a few minutes that I can allot here, so ladies, please identify yourselves and share with me quickly some of your thinking.
Good afternoon, Senator Shields and members of the committee. My name is Kathy Sansoni. I am a mom, a member of Stand for Children, and have taught for 31 years in the public schools. I obviously am an advocate for the Stand proposal with the lottery, simply because Oregon school children are really being shortchanged. Our class sizes are right now 30% higher than the rest of the nation. There are states that offer 20 more schools. school days in a year than we do. And so the need is very great. Here in Salem Kaiser, we've lost crucial reading recovery programs for our neediest first graders. Our buildings are not being repaired and maintained, and yet we crowd more and more children into them. So we must remember that these children are our investment in the future. We're not going to be able to attract more industry and businesses to Oregon when our school system is in the state that it is right now. We really believe that the lottery in Oregon was implemented to improve the quality of life for citizens, and in an economic crisis, we need to designate as much of the lottery funds as possible to public education. The money that can be gained for education in this process can simply allow schools to remain open for a full school year, which they aren't right now. It seems like when we're faced with those decisions, the answer ought to be crystal clear, and I just urge you to really take that into consideration when you're making these tough decisions. Thank you.
My name is Dana Hepper. I'm the Salem Kaiser organizer with Stand for Children. I'm here to speak in favor of this bill or either of the amendments. The amendment that would bring the rate from the new line games to 20% and leave the video poker games at 28%, which stays true to the current contract, would, given an 85% migration to line games, would result in an overall rate of 21.32%. We think that this is reasonable, given that every study done on the matter shows that anywhere between 4.5% to 20% would be a reasonable rate of return. So setting the line games at 20% really falls at the upper end of what is reasonable, and the blended rate at 21.32% really falls, you know, slightly above the upper end of what is reasonable, but is a much, much closer to reasonable than any of the, than the current situation or the recommendation of the lottery director, Dale Penn.
Thank you for clarifying that on how you arrived at that commission rate. I wasn't quite clear. Given the amount of time we have this afternoon, I'm going to let you slip back. I do want to say, you know, I don't have a whole committee here. On Tuesday, I'll have a whole committee here, okay? We're going to vote on this bill on Tuesday, okay? Senator Walker, unfortunately, is in Las Vegas today, not gambling. She's in some meetings. Why they want to meet in Las Vegas, don't ask me. I think their timing is lousy as far as their location relative to Oregon, but she'll be back. The whole committee, I assume, will be here, and some will weigh in on one side and some will weigh in on the other side. So we'll have a vote on Tuesday on this bill.
Chair Shields,
did you have a comment?
Like the representative of Stanford Children available at that?
I don't know whether we'll have any testimony or not at that point in time. You're certainly welcome to follow the issue. You know, my reaction to this is, you know, you can't find moral high ground in this. I mean, you know, this is a swamp any way you look at it. I mean, it's a choice between educating kids on the one hand and creating more gambling addicts on the other hand.
Yeah.
You know, and I have personally known one gambling addict that committed suicide. So you tell me where the moral high ground is here, you know. But this is what we've done to ourselves. We've got ourselves, the legislature, we have got ourselves addicted to gambling, to its revenue. So where we go from here, we're going to have a vote on Tuesday, okay? With that, I'd like to close the hearing on Senate Bill 498. And we want to, is there some stuff that we can get done real fast here? We have some two-minute hearings. If they go more than 2 minutes, they ain't going to get done because we're going to move on to the work session or the invited testimony and so on the SAFE bills within the next 5 to 10 minutes. I want to do that. So what bills are we doing now?
Okay, so
we're doing 155 and 156. These are reconsiderations of bills. And I'm going to recognize Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are we in, have we opened
work sessions?
We've opened work sessions. Can I do both at once, or do they have to do one
separately
at a time? Okay, Senate Bill 155, okay. Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move we reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 155 was moved to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. presentation for the purpose of re-referring it, the measure, to Ways and Means.
Not re-referring it, just referring it. Just referring it. We're not re-referring it.
Okay.
We're just referring it to Ways and
Means. I'm just reading my script.
Okay.
Oh, you know what? It does say referring.
Yeah.
Well, you know, clean your glasses, Gary. Okay.
Okay. Senator George moves that we reconsider the vote by which 155 was sent to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation for the purpose of referring the measure to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, that brings the measure back before the committee.
And
we had passed the measure as with an amendment, and so at this point you could entertain a motion.
He's got it.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we send Senate Bill 155 to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
As amended.
As amended, with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George moves Senate Bill 155 to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
As amended
with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any questions? Any objections? So ordered. Now let's do the same thing with Senate Bill 156.
Thank
We're opening a work session on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move we reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 156 was moved to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation for the purpose of referring the measure to Ways and Means.
Senator George moves that we reconsider the vote by which 156 was sent to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation for the purpose of referring the measure to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered. Now we have the bill in front of us. Can you do your thing one more time? Now we're referring it to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we send Senate Bill 156 to the Ways and Means Committee.
As amended.
As amended.
Senator George moves that we move Senate Bill 156 to the Ways and Means, as amended, to the Ways and Means Committee. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm glad that I walked in when I did. Just so the committee knows, I'm going to be asking the Legislative Council for an opinion on the constitutionality of this measure. So I won't slow it down going to Ways and Means, but I have serious concerns that this measure is unconstitutional.
Okie dokie. That's Senate Bill 156.
That's correct.
Okie dokie. Is there any other discussion? Is there any objection to sending it to Ways and Means? Hearing none, so ordered. Senate Bill 156, the hearing on Senate Bill 156 is closed. Now we have what I would like to call, I suppose, a work session and all the above.
Mm-hmm.
Senate Bill 310, 752, 984, and 986 at this point, and this is invited testimony, although I put out a kind of a request the other day that people please let us know if they wanted to be invited. And with that, I wanted to start with Brenda Rockland, asking her to come forward. I want to apologize to a lot of people who may be frustrated that they hadn't had an opportunity to testify before. It's never been my intention to cut anybody off from testifying. It's been a matter of just real tough timing on a lot, and just too much stuff on our plate. I can go one at a time, or I can invite multiples of people here. But I do have somewhat of a list in front of me, and we'll work our way down that list.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what would be most helpful to you in terms of how we proceed this afternoon?
That's a pretty open-ended question.
Yes, it is.
I had assumed that since you've already presented your Senate Bill 310 and so on, that you would potentially respond to some of the testimony on Thursday that we had, not Thursday, Tuesday. This is Thursday, right?
Yes, sir.
And that would be the testimony from John DiLorenzo. Is that okay?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that would be not only okay, but I would welcome the opportunity to respond to Mr. DiLorenzo's comments on Tuesday.
Excuse me. I was distracted. My apologies.
No problem.
What did you say?
I will proceed to address Mr. DiLorenzo's Tuesday testimony, Mr. Chair. And for the record, Brenda Rocklin, interim president and CEO of Safe Corporation. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you again for the opportunity to address Mr. DiLorenzo's Tuesday testimony. I would like to make just a few remarks before Chris Davey and I address Mr. DiLorenzo's specific points. As this committee knows, Mr. Davey and I have spent a considerable amount of time before this committee, both during the interim session and during this legislative session.
And I hope you're not charging me lawyers' rates by the hour.
No, but our lawyers are. I would tell you that what we have tried to do was to be forthright and helpful in providing pertinent information to this committee. Since August, I've also had the opportunity to meet with Mr. DiLorenzo on a number of occasions, including the discussion of legislative concept as well as court hearings. I believe he knows that I am generally willing to meet with just about everybody, and that I try to be direct and open with everyone I talk to. Tuesday night, following Mr. DiLorenzo's testimony, I told him that I was disappointed that he had not talked to me before his testimony. And I was disappointed because I believe that had he talked to me or to Mr. Davey, we could have put to rest many of the concerns that he raised Tuesday afternoon so that we would not have had to waste this committee's time today with what I believe are non-issues. I think I can illustrate what I mean by non-issues by addressing one of the concerns that Mr. DiLorenzo raised on page 6 of his written testimony. On that page, he referred to what he called a mysterious email that Safe Corporation had turned over to him in response to one of his public records requests. And we have attached a copy of that email again to our written testimony before the committee today so that you would have an opportunity to refer to it one more time. I can see why Mr. DiLorenzo might have felt that was a mysterious email, because if you compare it to what we've also attached as a regular email from Safe Corporation, it does vary. But in his oral testimony before this committee, he went beyond his written testimony and went so far as to suggest that Safe may have edited the email before we gave it to him. Had he simply asked me or Mr. Davey what was going on with the mysterious email, I would have explained to him why that particular email looks different from other emails that he had received in response to his public records request. Mr. DiLorenzo made a public records request in January of 2005, asking for all of Safe's group contracts and documents relating to those group contracts. In an effort to comply with that request, we asked Safe employees to search their written and electronic files to comply with Mr. DiLorenzo's public records request. Before we could fully respond to his request, David Thurber, the former Vice President for Policyholder Services, resigned from Safe Corporation. As a result of that resignation, I asked Pam Jordan, who was the Vice President of our Information Systems, to conduct an electronic search of all of Mr. Thurber's files so that we could comply with Mr. DiLorenzo's public records request. Ms. Jordan was able to locate a number of emails that we believe were responsive to Mr. DiLorenzo's request, and we printed those out and made those available to him. After Mr. Thurber left Safe Corporation, his access to the email system was not surprisingly disabled, and that is why when you look at that mysterious email, the top of it contains the name Pam Jordan instead of David Thurber, because at that point Mr. Thurber did not have an email account and we had to go back in electronically and pull those through Pam Jordan's email account. The reason that the email in question doesn't contain other identifying information, which Mr. DiLorenzo brought to this committee's attention, such as the date it was sent or the name of the sender, is because that email was never sent to anyone. It was located because we did a thorough search of all of Mr. Thurber's email folders, and we located an email that had never been sent to anyone, which was addressed to me, but we went ahead and printed it out and provided it to Mr. DiLorenzo in any event. Thus, far from suggesting that we engaged in any questionable conduct, the disclosure of this email actually demonstrates safe diligence in trying to comply with Mr. DiLorenzo's numerous public records requests. He also made a great deal out of an email that contains a designation of XOXO. I've addressed that in our written testimony, and quite frankly, I don't think it merits a further response unless the committee has specific questions. And if you do, I would be happy to respond to that in addition to our written testimony. I want to make one final point regarding public records before Chris addresses some concerns raised regarding the AOI contract. And that is that Mr. DiLorenzo continues to assert that he won't get copies of group contracts in the future if this committee adopts the public records portion of Senate Bill 310 that Safe Corporation is proposing. I will tell the committee that I strongly disagree that that is the intent or the meaning of Senate Bill 310. With rare exceptions, contracts entered into by public agencies in this state, including Safe Corporation, are public records, and they're releasable to the public pursuant to a public records request under the Public Records Act. I believe the Department of Justice is present today and would be happy to confirm that fact. And at this point, I'll turn it over to Chris to talk about the AOI contract, and then I'll come back and make some final points regarding Mr. DiLorenzo's testimony.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Chris Davey with Safe Corporation. I'd like to speak specifically to the issues that were raised about the renegotiation of the contract with AOI. Mr. DiLorenzo spoke on Tuesday. He devoted about 4 pages of his 11-page testimony to talking about this renegotiation process. And unfortunately, once again, he failed to ask questions about what the documents that he had received really meant, and has instead chosen to assign some sinister motives to things that are, in fact, quite benign. He did get some things right. He reported that AOI did ask for a full agency appointment in 2003, and that SAFE then went through a business analysis of whether it was appropriate to make that appointment and decided that there was not a good business case for that, and in fact SAFE did turn that down. He was also correct in noting that SAFE and AOI did enter into a limited agency agreement in September 2004, and that's the same kind of contract that we have with 55 other agencies around the state. Rather than noting the significant difference between a full and a limited appointment, Mr. DiLorenzo said that this demonstrated that SAFE completely reversed its prior policy. Just how limited that new agency appointment is will be demonstrated when we talk about the compensation that was involved. But rather than paying AOI a commission on every piece of business that is in the group, that new limited appointment would only compensate AOI if a new piece of business was brought to SAFE that was not already represented by another insurance agent. Next, Mr. DiLorenzo points to a December 6, 2004 letter from Mr. Buttrick of AOI in which he proposed an alternative to the current contract and suggested that a new agency contract could pay 3% of the premium for the CompWise and the CompSafe groups. Mr. DiLorenzo pointed to what he describes as a most telling handwritten notation by an unidentified SAFE official, in his words, suggesting that Mr. Buttrick's proposal will generate $1.3 million annually for AOI versus $610,000 lost. And Mr. DiLorenzo again asserts that SAFE has once again found a way to more than replace the revenues which have been lost to AOI by reason of SAFE's elimination of the funding of Business Viewpoint. What Mr. DiLorenzo did not point out to the committee is that SAFE has not entered into any contract in those terms, and has not contemplated a contract on those terms. The telling notation for the committee should simply tell the committee that SAFE was quick to note the disparity in the total compensation that might be paid to AOI. Unfortunately, Mr. DiLorenzo, despite receiving many documents, and this packet represents the documents that were provided to him in January of this year in relation to this request, but those documents have been selectively presented to this committee. The documents that you've seen have been attempting to characterize as supporting his proposition, while the committee has been deprived of other documents that would give it the full picture. Attachment 3 to our testimony is the actual application from AOI for a limited agency appointment. And as the committee can see on, I believe, the third page of that application, the projected annual premium for this agency would be $50,000, which at a maximum 5% commission rate would yield $2,500 per year. And this document was disclosed to Mr. DiLorenzo. He chose not to disclose it to the committee.
Okay, let's slow down just a minute and give us time to look at this. You're saying...
This, Mr. Chair, this is the attachment 3. They should
right.
be separated by yellow.
And I'm looking at attachment 3.
And go to page 3. It's shown as 3-3 in the bottom right-hand corner of the page.
Yeah, and I'm looking at that, and I understand it says $50,000. I understand all of that. What I'm interested in is another little piece of information. Where does it say in here that this is just for new business? That's what I'm looking for, and that's explained briefly below there.
Right in the center of the page.
In the center of the page. Okay. So it's just for new business.
The anticipated volume of business under this contract was to be $50,000 in new business for the first year.
Okay.
Which would yield a maximum commission of $2,500. But how much has AOI actually received under that agency agreement? The first check was written in December of 2004. That check was for $26.30. The second check, written in March 2005, was for $2.95. The total amount of this so-called sweetheart deal so far has been $29.25. And additional supporting documents are attached as attachment number 4. With regard to the return on investment chart that was supplied by Mr. DiLorenzo, he points out that overall there is reported negative experience over a 9-year period, but and I did not attach this chart here, but it was part of his documents on Tuesday. The most recent 2 years show that the results of that group have actually been very positive. And I think the committee needs to bear in mind that all of these documents that relate to negotiations with AOI are relative to attempts to renegotiate the existing contract. As you've heard before, this contract runs through the end of 2005, and we're contractually obligated to pay a sum of money to AOI for the production of the Business Viewpoint magazine. Our board has suggested that we should try to renegotiate that contract, and we've been in discussions with AOI for some time about that. And so the context of these negotiations is to renegotiate the existing contract. This is not about a new contract. There may perhaps in the future be a new contract, but whether that exists, what the size of that contract is, what the scope of that might be, are an entirely separate matter. Mr. DiLorenzo also found fault with the content of a memo that Mr. David Thurber sent to SAFE's Board of Director on January the 17th, 2005, and claims that various information should have been added to that memo. And once again, that memo was used simply for the purpose of keeping the board up to date with the negotiations that were taking place that they had requested. If this memo had in fact been one that was proposing a new contract, then of course the issues that he has raised should have been made available to the board, but that was not the context, and Mr. DiLorenzo should have been aware of that because one of his associates, Mr. Devin Lyon, was present at that board meeting and heard that discussion.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I could just follow up with a few final comments about some of the issues, other issues raised by Mr. DiLorenzo in his testimony on Tuesday. First of all, he also raised a number of concerns regarding SAFE's group contract with AGC, specifically two issues. One, he criticized the contract we have with AGC because it does not specifically spell out what AGC can't use money for, and specifically that they can't use the money for political purposes, and also found fault with the fact that the audit language in that particular contract is permissive rather than mandatory. So let me take those two issues. The contract that we entered into with AGC in September of 2004 was reviewed by the Oregon Department of Justice before it was signed by the parties. The department made a couple of changes to the contract. They approved the specific contract for legal sufficiency. The contract spells out the services that AGC must perform to receive payments from SAFE Corporation. I guess we could have spelled out that what we won't pay for, but that seems redundant given the fact that the contract sets out the specific items that will warrant payment. Mr. DiLorenzo also suggests that SAFE is not serious about auditing group contracts because we've used permissive language in the contract with AGC rather than mandatory language. Once again, had Mr. DiLorenzo simply asked me before the hearing what I was doing in terms of auditing group contracts, I would have told him the following. As this committee well knows, I made a recommendation to Governor Kulongoski on February 15th that I felt all of SAFE's group contracts should be audited over the coming year. I told this committee the same thing. On March 10th, well before Mr. DiLorenzo testified this week, I had my first meeting with SAFE staff with an independent auditor and went over with the independent auditor the fact that SAFE wanted group contracts audited over the coming year. On March 24th, again, well before Mr. DiLorenzo appeared before the committee earlier this week, we sent materials to an independent auditor so that they could prepare an audit proposal for SAFE staff and the SAFE board to review and approve. I said we'd do audits of group contracts. We've taken steps to move forward, and it's simply not true that we don't intend to do that. Mr. DiLorenzo has raised a number of concerns regarding campaign contributions, and I think it's probably more appropriate for this committee to hear from AOI, AGC, and AOL if they wish to be heard, because I think they would welcome the opportunity to respond to Mr. DiLorenzo's comments regarding those campaign contributions. Finally, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mr. DiLorenzo went to great lengths on Tuesday to point out that I have generally agreed with many of the points he's made regarding the past behavior of SAFE Corporation. His criticism is not with the positions I've taken. His criticism is that I have not put forth a legislative concept that addresses each and every one of those issues. He's absolutely right in that sense. I simply disagree with him that the way to ensure good management is to put everything in a statute. Senate Bill 310 contains some key general provisions for SAFE oversight that we have drafted and that we hope the committee supports. We do not support Mr. DiLorenzo's legislative ideas as presented in his testimony on Tuesday. Mr. Davey and I are happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Are there questions that the committee has? We're absorbing up here. We're underlining. I did interrupt with a few little questions. You've got other attachments here. Any comments about what these are?
Mr. Chair, good question. Let me just address the final attachment, which is attachment 5. That really relates specifically to the campaign contribution allegation made by Mr. DiLorenzo. Specifically in his testimony, as you may recall, there was some question that maybe the campaign contributions had some relationship to the amount of money that Safe Corporation gave AOI, AGC, and AOL during last year's campaign season, and we simply attach documents to show that if you look at the payments that we've made to those associations over the years, the amounts have not varied dramatically, and to the extent the amounts have varied and have gone up, it's been related to premium, not doesn't have anything to do with any campaigns.
Okay. Are there any other questions right now? Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, Brenda, I'm sure the Attorney General has cautioned you and every other agency that anything you send out an email is in effect a contract. And when someone writes 8 times XOXO with XOXO, and then the charge is made against Mr. DiLorenzo that he has a fertile imagination. Before he made a statement the other day, I looked at him and said, how inappropriate, how unprofessional. And I'm a little bit disturbed by that. I just wrote down a few things as we were going through this. Fertile imagination, very selective. He did not declare to the committee, and a couple other statements like that, that I don't think they're appropriate. I'm going to be very honest. For an agency to respond back to someone who has legitimate concerns, because when I looked at that portfolio we were presented with, I have big concerns about it. And I want to share with everybody today one thing, if I could. This is not a question, Mr. Chairman, but if I could, I received a phone call today, an almost desperate phone call from a former constituent encouraging me not to destroy SAFE. And when I said to him after listening to him for a few minutes, I said, who told you to call me? And it was AGC told him to call me. And so what I'm going to suggest to you is that we have lobbying that's still going on. And I assured him that there was nobody in this committee that intended to hurt SAFE. That many of us were, you know, were customers of SAFE, and we intended to do good. But what I'm saying is I continue to see a pattern of this kind of behavior, and I'm getting a little bit tired of it. Thank you for hearing me.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, if I might just respond briefly to that, I appreciate those concerns. I guess my point on that, having sat here on Tuesday, is that many of these issues that Mr. DiLorenzo raised certainly would have been, had that been the case, I certainly think that would have been cause for concern. My point is simply, had we sat down and talked about this, as I certainly would have been willing to do, I think I could have allayed a lot of Mr. DiLorenzo's concerns about some of these emails, some of the documents, would have been willing to answer any questions he had about those documents, and I think then we could have clarified many of those issues.
Brenda, follow up. Isn't it correct that they've had to go to court repeatedly to get information?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, that has simply not been the case since August 12th. We have turned over document after document after document, not in response to a court order. I mean, obviously the contempt case was out there based on past conduct, but I think Mr. DiLorenzo has been fair in letting Judge Lipscomb know that we have really, I think, done a good job of searching our records and turning things over recently. So I don't think that has been the case, and I don't think Mr. DiLorenzo would say that's been the case since August.
Thank you.
And the operative date, August 12th, is when you began your service.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Senator Berger.
Mr. Chair, I was concerned in the very beginning of these hearings. I have not lost that concern. I appreciate the work that people are doing, but you are defending people that are not here. You're defending people that have left that organization. I truly believe, Mr. Chair, they should be subpoenaed. I think we should be talking to the people that made the decisions that brought this controversy forth. And I do appreciate your coming in, as you did with the lottery, and trying to straighten things out. But I will never feel that it's the same as directly talking and interrogating the people that made the decisions that you now are left to try to unravel and protect the reputation of Safe Corporation.
Senator Verger, let me respond in a very direct way. I'm led to believe that if we had the former executive in here, all we would get would be some pretty good theater, because she would take the Fifth Amendment and we wouldn't really get anything. And so that's been my hesitancy on that point. Now, the other day, Senator Walker suggested we potentially subpoena Mr. Thurber. I don't know about that situation, and I'm certainly open to comment if you guys want to comment on that. But why would we subpoena somebody who's potentially going to take the Fifth Amendment? I don't know the status, but I assume under investigation and so on.
May I respond to that, Mr. Chair? I think an individual that has been asked to come in order to clarify some things that look to us like they may have been poor decisions and takes the Fifth Amendment makes a very big statement. It's a nonverbal statement that will ring through the walls of this room. And she's certainly capable of taking the Fifth, but I would certainly be happy to see her take the Fifth, for she would then have answered all the questions that I have.
Okay. You and I need to have a further discussion.
Yes, sir.
Of that?
That would be fine.
If I put it up to a committee vote, I wonder what would happen. Do we have more questions? I'm going to keep you here, Brenda, and if you if more questions come, we might return to you. But I'm going to ask right now if Jessica Harris would come forward, if she's here. I don't know if she's on her own or accompanied by anybody, but I have invited testimony in a sense, but also Corey Streisinger's here and says she's available for questions, so I ask the committee to keep that in mind in case they want to chat with her. Jessica, I'm sorry it's taken us so long to get you in front of the committee. Again, my apologies. I had no intention of being an impediment to free speech. The only thing that determines free speech seems to be that clock on the wall.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. We're glad to be here. I'd like to introduce you to my executive director, Mr. Craig Honeyman, that will present our testimony today.
Thank you, Senator, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Craig Honeyman, and I'm the Executive Director of the Associated General Contractors Oregon Columbia Chapter. AGC represents nearly 1,100 member firms in the commercial construction industry. We build Oregon's bridges, schools, hospitals, and community centers. Our members are union and open shop. They are large businesses and small businesses, and we are the largest commercial construction industry trade association in Oregon and Southwest Washington. On behalf of the companies I represent, I appreciate the opportunity to be here this afternoon to share with this committee the facts about AGC's workers' comp program, as well as AGC's position on pieces of legislation and proposal that you've been hearing about for the last few months. As I share with you the details of this program, it is important for you as legislators to know that the bedrock, the basis for this program, is safety. Our mission is to make the construction industry safer, a goal that is continually being achieved. In fact, in the last 10 years, the claim frequency of the AGC Group program has decreased by more than 60%. First, I'd like to share some history. Group workers' compensation insurance is not a new product at AGC. In fact, for the last 13 years, AGC has had a program with Safe Corporation. Before Safe, AGC had a group program with Liberty Northwest. Our first program was offered in the 1985-86 plan year with 282 companies and roughly $3 million in premium. Today, our group is 737 companies strong and represents more than 10 times the amount of premium it did 20 years ago. The participants in our group employ 28,000 employees by our account and represent more than $1 billion in payroll. AGC's contract with SAFE is a reimbursable contract that is renegotiated every year. A reimbursable contract means we only get paid for the services we provide. If we don't spend the money under the contract, we must return the money to Safe Corporation at the end of the plan year. Contract negotiations are nearly a year-long process. In fact, AGC and SAFE are currently working on the 2005-2006 plan year contract right now. The process involves a careful
examination.
Yes.
Excuse me. What it seems to me is that you're in ongoing kind of a never-ending cycle of contracts. I mean, you renegotiate every year, and it usually takes you a year or so. So you're kind of always in that process. Is that right,
Mr. Chair? Yes, that is the case, and that's because we really have about a 4 maybe 5 month gap, and then we restart because
right. It
is a lengthy process.
Okay, thank you. I'm just clarifying.
Yeah. Oh yes.
This process involves a careful examination of the program design as well as the services we offer as part of the contract. AGC and SAFE go through several drafts, and AGC prepares detailed budget data showing where monies would be allocated under the contract. The 2004-2005 contract, our current contract, is for $1.388 million. This represents roughly 4% of the premiums paid by our members. The contract amount is built into the calculation of premiums our members pay. No other group or other SAFE insured company outside our group pays for the administration of our group. Allegations have been made about where the money under the ADC group contract goes, but here are the facts. 8% of the money is used for rent and utilities. 22% is used to put fuel in the vehicles of our safety and loss control consultants so that they can spend every day on the road and in the field or on the job site working with our members. It's used to purchase safety videos for trainings on things such as fall protection and ladder safety. The money is used to upgrade computers and enhance our loss control computer application of our safety experts to provide better service to our members. The remaining 70% of the money is for salaries and benefits of the nine safety and loss control consultants, one administrator, and one administrative assistant AGC employees to provide the safety services specified in the contract. The specificity of the contract speaks for itself, and as I understand that Mr. DiLorenzo has already provided you with a copy of our contract for this plan year. For your convenience, I have attached to my testimony an additional copy of the addendum to the contract that spells out the kinds of services paid by AGC, provided by AGC.
Can we take a moment and look at that while you're it's at the back end of this?
It's the last three pages.
Okay. Is there any comments you'd like to make on it? What did you say? You said something about it spells out what would happen, and that's the reimbursable expenses? Is that category there?
Mr. Chair, this section, the addendum, outlines for AGC and SAFE. It's what tells us what specific safety and loss control services we must provide under the contract. So you'll see that it talks about us needing to provide those services and visit them on a regular basis and provide information to them, making oral and written communications back and forth between our members as well as SAFE and all of the services, the page and a half of specificity on the kinds of activities that we need to be engaged in.
That's the A through M categories on pages 1 and 2?
Yes.
Other questions as you look through those, committee? I guess I should say committee and staff in case you see any.
Mr. Chair, we believe that this kind of specificity represents to the committee the kind of commitment that SAFE has and the purpose of our program, which is safety.
Okay. Mr. Chair, may I ask a question?
Sure.
I apologize for having to step out, but I wanted to go and get my copy that I left up in my office. But I understand, after I quickly read the first part of Mr. Honeyman's testimony, that AGC has had a contract with Liberty at one point.
At one time.
Could you comment on the difference between the contract that we're looking at here between SAFE and AGC and perhaps the contract that you had with Liberty?
This was before my time as executive director of Associated General Contractors. This goes back to the late 1980s, early 1990s. I have not reviewed that contract personally. I can tell you, though, that the decision was made by my board to switch from Liberty Northwest to SAFE because of SAFE's specific commitment to loss control, the issue we're talking about right now, the nine people I have out in the field, their dedicated claims staff. We've noticed that claim service, which benefits the worker, the injured employee, has been greatly improved with SAFE, and their dedication to providing return-to-work consultants for the injured worker, and, by the way, an improved bottom line, a reduced or a less expensive premium.
Mr. Chair, the one of the other benefits of the program is that there is, in the SAFE AGC arrangement, part of the upfront discussion was that not only do they have a great claims staff, but that AGC would have claims specialists that are specialized in the construction industry itself, that work with AGC accounts so that when a claim comes in, there are a group of people at SAFE that work with those 737 companies that are part of our group to go through those claims, look at them from, okay, knowing the construction industry, how do we get that claim processed quickly so that we can deal with early return to work and return to work. We have return to work consultants that are specialists in the construction industry who know our members, who know the client base, so that as we are working through those issues, trying to get that injured employee out of their house and back onto the job site, we've got that kind of expertise. That was a unique addition to our program with SAFE as opposed to Liberty. The kind of conditions that you see here in this partnership services agreement, that the specific mentioning of safety services were not in the Liberty agreement. We would, be happy to provide you more information on that.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm kind of interested on page 2 of your testimony in the second to bottom paragraph. You talked about 22% of the contract goes to put fuel in the vehicles of our safety loss consultants. I won't make wisecracks about how good a mileage you're getting, but that means you're doing an awful lot of driving. They're covering a lot of territory. There are nine of these consultants. Could you give me just anecdotal information about, are each of them specialists in different areas of safety with different type kind of things? What's a day look like as they're running around? Just a little bit of feel for this.
There are nine of them. They do operate a Ford Explorer SUV, which is fully laden with safety education material, televisions for on-site video, lunchbox, noontime safety presentations. Each of these nine loss control consultants has a book of business, a list of contractors that are in there that are their clients. They are broken down by geography. We cover the entire state of Oregon, and it's not unusual for a loss control consultant to start his day in Coos Bay and wind up in Medford, maybe wind up back in Coos Bay before the day is over with. So you're correct, Senator, there's some mileage put on these vehicles. They have responsibility to meet with our members on a periodic basis at the job site where there's construction going on, and some of these visits, many of these visits are unannounced, and they're also available to respond to and often do receive calls from our members to show up on the job site and consult on safety-related matters.
Well, what happens on an unannounced visit sometimes? Give me some...
Having been on, I ask my staff, and I include myself in that, to do some ride-alongs with our loss control consultants so we can see what it is they do. They will walk a job site making notes about any number of potential violations, OSHA violations that might exist, or potential hazards, future hazards. They'll consult with a project manager on the job site to see if he or she has any questions about the safety services or the safety standards that they should be adhering to and the safety services that we provide.
So you're kind of saying, hey, you better get this corrected before the big boys show up or something.
Correct.
Before there's an injury.
Before there's an injury.
Before there's an injury. Okay. Senator Verger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to say my questioning of you has absolutely nothing to do with my approval of the SAFE program. My own business and all those in my business district have had similar experiences to yours. They fully support the workman's comp program that is there. My questioning is about good business practices that have perhaps been made in the past. And it has nothing to do. We can take a good program and have some poor business practices. And so I guess I only have one question, Jessica, and if you were involved in the contracts that were made, were you involved in making the contract or in renegotiating or...
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, no, I'm not in this contract.
All right. Because I think my question would be, at any time did AGC, who is highly respected, sense that there were poor business practices being made? And I think that's important to me, that of the people that were dealing with individuals, not the workman's comp program, but individuals, that would have given some indication that there was an out of control kind of decision making. And can either one of you, were either one of you involved in the new renegotiations of your contracts or informing those?
Senator Shields, Chairman Senator Berger, I am ultimately responsible for what goes into that contract. A member of my staff actually sits in on the negotiations, as do contractor members of my organization. I review the contract. I can tell you honestly, in answer to your second question, I'm not aware of anything in my dealings with the agency. Certainly under its current administration nor its prior administration that caused me any reason to be concerned.
I want to follow up also by saying, and I've said it before in these hearings, but I want to say it again, that I think they could not have selected a better person than Brenda Rockland to come in and try to recover and straighten out. When other people fumble, then there's always somebody that can grab the ball and run the touchdown, and she can do it. But that does not excuse those people who have been at liberty to do whatever they wanted to do. All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Starr.
Thank you very much. The question I have is regarding audits. Has your agreement with SAFE ever been audited in the past by an outside independent audit?
It has. Again, I think, Senator, this precedes my time at AGC, but we have been audited. We are open to an audit either by SAFE or an external audit. I think we've expect an audit, and I believe I just heard a few minutes ago from Ms. Rockland that we will get one. We're open to it and prepared to cooperate fully.
And then, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Since we have Mr. Honeyman here in front of me, I appreciate reading your testimony, reading the details of your specific agreement with SAFE Corporation. I clearly, for AGC, this is a very, and for AGC members, not for AGC, but for your members, turned out to be a really great program. I mean, you've seen a situation where injuries have come down, and you've got folks out there in the field that are able to consult with your members, and I think it's great. I think it's good. The question I have is for you is, how would this change? How would your relationship with SAFE change if your members, instead of having the relationship they have now with SAFE, owned SAFE through a mutual insurance company and SAFE had become a private company? How would that change this whole dynamic, other than take it off the legislative radar, which I think would be tremendous?
We would think that would be tremendous.
I would agree with that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, we haven't sat down with an actuary or anyone else to talk about what would happen in terms of rates and rate structure should SAFE become mutualized as opposed to remaining the public corporation it is today. And as you can imagine, our contractor members are very concerned about changing the system and what would happen if we were to move SAFE from being a public corporation to a private entity, and what would that change about rating structure and the competitive nature of the market. But we just don't know. Would we like to see this issue depoliticized? Absolutely. We're happy to be here today. We wish we didn't have to be here today, I think, is the feeling of AGC and of our members.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up on that point, I think that your members, and rightly so, you know, the unknown, what would the change mean, and what would that mean to the whole environment? I understand that, and I think that's valid, no question. But the reality is, we're changing anyway. We're not going to go back to the same old way that SAFE had operated, where legislators and the public had no idea about what was happening within the agency. And again, I echo the comments of the good senator from South Coast about Ms. Rocklin and what she's done to the agency. This relationship's going to change. How it impacts anybody, nobody really knows. And so I guess that's a statement, not necessarily a question. You could be happy to respond to it. And I know, Mr. Chair, we interrupted Mr. Honeyman midway through his testimony, so yeah, I'm cognizant of that as well.
I know that we interrupted Mr. Honeyman, and I don't know if you want to read it all, since I know that a lot of us up here cheat and have read ahead. While we try, we're always multitasking. I have, for instance, noticed the governor's occupational safety awards that you mentioned on page 3. I noticed how over the last 10 years your frequency of claims has dropped 60%, and that does mean people go home without injury and without paralysis and so on. I guess I'd like to ask you, if you would, to pick up the testimony. You say in the top of page 4 that, having shared the background, you'd like to specifically and precisely respond to allegations.
Happy,
so would you start there?
Sure.
And when there are opportunities, summarize rather than reading every word.
Senator, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to continue. It's been alleged that ADC provides political cover for SAFE through this preferential group contract, that essentially the ADC program is corrupt. First of all, I want to say that that allegation is infuriating to my board of directors and to my membership. They take umbrage at erroneous statements being given the slightest bit of credence in this building, especially considering that the source of these statements are from the very entities that engaged in a campaign to get rid of SAFE altogether. First, ADC's board of directors makes all of the decisions about the activity that my organization engages in regarding political campaigns and legislative bills. SAFE is not represented either by a board member or staff on our board of directors, nor do they have a seat on our legislative committee. They have no vote or say regarding our political positions, and our board, which is comprised of SAFE insureds, Liberty insureds, self-insureds, and those that are insured by other private carriers, deliberate at length on these issues and make their decisions based on what is best for the association and for the construction industry. Now, it's true that sometimes those decisions coincide with positions of SAFE Corporation, but why is that reality considered so sinister by some? Contractors have long been defenders of the system as a whole. The system provides choices for contractors to purchase from a private carrier, to self-insure, and to purchase from SAFE Corporation. It is this system that has produced competitively priced products for our members to everyone's benefit. When faced with an issue that would undo the system or a portion thereof, we'll stand up every time to oppose such a change. Mr. Chair, if there was a bill to prohibit private insurers from writing in the Oregon market, you'd better believe that ADC would be standing here firm in opposing that legislation, not because of any relationship we have or don't have, but because it takes away choices. In short, we are not SAFE's political cover. If we had a program with Liberty Northwest, we wouldn't be their cover. We're political advocates for our members for the construction industry, the member firms in your districts who build your communities. That's what we're here for. Other allegations have been raised about how AGC spends the money it receives from the premiums paid by its group members for administration. Specifically, the charge has been laid that we use money for political purposes. AGC does not use any of the $1.388 million for political purposes. Not a penny of that money will go to our political action committees. None of the monies are currently being, nor will they be used, to pay for our contract lobbying firm or to pay the salaries of our in-house lobbyists. I have previously outlined how we utilize the monies we receive. A full breakdown of those expenditures is provided to SAFE prior to the signing of the contract, and we are subject to audit at any time. Again, let me emphasize, no monies are used for political purposes. Additional allegations have been levied at AGC that we somehow have been let free from the audit requirement under the contract. Previously responded to our openness to an audit. We understand that the contract enables SAFE to do so at its pleasure, and we understand that that we can expect one perhaps this year. And we heard that confirmed just a few moments ago. In short, we have nothing to hide, and we are awaiting word on when the audit will commence. Finally, there have been numerous allegations about our activity relative to ballot measure 38. In various venues, AGC has been accused of using premium dollars to finance its contributions and loans to the Committee for Safekeeping. We have been accused of bullying our members into participating in the campaign. Allegations of political protectionism have run rampant through this building during the public debate, and thank you for this opportunity to set the record straight. AGC did support the Committee for Safekeeping, the committee formed to oppose ballot measure 38, because we wouldn't stand by idly and watch one private company rip this state apart. We refused to sit on our hands while one insurance company took advantage of the initiative system to eliminate its competition. AGC's board made the decision to tap into our reserves to help loan the committee money it needed to protect the Oregon workers' comp system. Our reserves are monies that have been built up over time from membership dues and stock market earnings, not from SAFE premiums. We were very active in encouraging members to contribute personally and voluntarily to the campaign, and some of the loan was repaid through contributions our members voluntarily made to the campaign committee. AGC's board acted legally, ethically, and responsibly to a threat it could not ignore. The debate that has rocked this building from time to time was taken to the streets, not by the customers, but by SAFE's rival. And when they chose a street fight, we were forced to meet them in the streets to protect the system, and we did, successfully. Voters rejected the measure, as you know, by a 60-40 margin. The same arguments and allegations that have been laid before this committee were broadcast in a huge paid advertising campaign financed by Liberty. The voters spoke. We and you should listen. Contractors are shrewd business people. They look at the bottom line cost effectiveness of any program that they buy. Our contractors choose our program because it makes the most sense for their company. Participating companies not only receive a competitively priced product, but they also receive some of the best loss control and safety programs available. To go into the private sector and try to replicate these services on their own would be extremely expensive and simply doesn't pencil for many of my members. AGC urges this committee to reject legislation that will hamper the ability of SAFE, hamper the ability to make SAFE a competitive worker, a provider of workers' compensation insurance. We encourage you to reject legislation that is masked as reform, but is a less than veiled effort to eliminate the kinds of programs that we have that have created safer work environments, like our AGC group program. Mr. Chair, AGC supports reasonable reforms to SAFE to ensure the kind of transparency that we believe Ms. Rockland and her current management team are bringing to SAFE without legislation. Senate Bill 310 in its current form makes those necessary kinds of reforms, and we support that bill. On behalf of my members and their employees, though, please do not undermine Oregon's workers' compensation system that works by promoting safe workplaces and providing competitive rates. Thank you very much for your attention. And let me say, and especially Senator Shields, in response to some of your specific questions about what an LCC does in the field, I extend to all of you members of the committee, staff, committee members who are not here, an invitation to, at your convenience, join one of our LCCs on the road for a day in the field and see exactly what it is they do. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that invitation. I I think it'd be a lot more educational than sitting in this building sometimes. So thank you very much for that. Senator George.
Are we open on 310, 752, and 984?
Yeah, we've opened on all of them.
Okay. What part of those bills is going to damage SAFE?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, we believe that 310 is a positive bill, that SAFE has taken good steps to resolve not only internally but publicly some of the credibility issues they have. AGC believes that there needs to be transparency there. That's why we're so open to being audited and happy to do so. Mr. Chair, Senator George, to address another issue that you raised and some concern about a phone call that you received from one of our...
No. I don't care about that. I want to know what part of these three bills that are open right now that
right.
We're supposed to be addressing.
There's four bills open.
Well, Senate Bill 310 we support. Senate Bill 984, our concern about 984 is that it would, we believe, upset the market as it is today by making SAFE, though not exclusively, essentially the insurer of last resort. Our concern is that doesn't allow SAFE to do what it needs to today to competitively price the market, but also do as much as possible to reach out to those that don't otherwise get insurance in the voluntary market. So I think that balance is being met today, and that's proven by how many small businesses SAFE does insure against those that are otherwise in the marketplace, as well as the competitive prices it can provide Oregon contractors and others. So, I mean, that bill, we believe, would undo the system itself. 752, we don't necessarily have a position on 752. We haven't taken as close a look at that bill as we should, and I apologize. I need to look at the other bill that's up here. I apologize. What's the other bill that's open?
986.
986. Mr. Chair, Senator George, 986 essentially eliminates group programs. And AGC, is as you have heard, hopefully in our testimony today, and is I'm sure the contractor members that are part of your district would tell you that program delivers on a daily basis individuals with real faces and real expertise, award-winning safety professionals to their door to help them work through the safety issues on their job site that have saved lives. We know that our program, when you reduce claims frequency by 60%, those are lives. Those are people who haven't fallen off the buildings or who have learned proper safety practices that they won't just carry today, that is the number today, but it's the rest of their lives and the people that they will train that will know the kind of proper safety practices that will make this entire industry safer, whether they stay with the member firm or not. The industry is safer because of the program we have in place.
Thank you very much. I think we'll let you folks step back.
I appreciate it.
I'm concerned that the time is going to get away from us here. And I'm going to ask Richard Buttrick if he'll come up. I don't know if we can give you as much time as we gave the rest. I didn't bring a lunch bucket this evening. But we'd like you to hold forth for a while. I hope we can get to Jim Geisinger. I do know that in about 25, 30 minutes, I need to return to Senate Bill 511. So let's move along. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, I enjoyed listening to the testimony earlier because I cooled off slightly from what I was about to read in our testimony. But having said that, this last Tuesday, John Lee, I'm Richard Buttrick of AOI, and my colleague is Lisa Trussell, Vice President of AOI. Last Tuesday, John D. Lorenzo, a partner in Davis Wright Tremaine Law Firm, representing Oregonians for Sound Economic Policy, did testify about SAFE. Now, you will recall that John D. Lorenzo specifically referred to me by name. insinuating improper practices and sweetheart deals with Safe Corporation. His claims are outrageously incorrect. And I appreciate Senator Shields, Chairman, allowing me a little bit of time to address some of those issues. I'll just touch on a few of the most outrageous falsehoods. And I'd be happy to come in at any time in the future and give you a more complete review if that's your desire. But I do believe that you'll find what I have to say fairly summarized my thoughts. You have a booklet. And interestingly enough, it's white. And it has tabs on it to make it easier for you all to follow my testimony.
So many trees have died.
Of this issue. Yes.
In Mr. DiLorenzo's testimony, pages 4 and 5 of his testimony implies I was not forthright with my response to Ms. Rockland question regarding SAFE's dues going for political campaigns and political contributions. Davis Wright Germain's insinuations are false. No SAFE dues go to any political campaign. Page 5 of the Davis Wright Germain testimony implies that AOI Service Corporation derives all its funding from SAFE. Again, that's false. We have previously provided this entire committee the information on our numerous programs available to our members of the AOI Service Corps, and that came in a packet at your request, Mr. Chairman, some time ago. Pages 5 and 6 of the Davis Wright Germain testimony, it appears that Davis Wright Germain does not understand the difference between a full insurance agency, which we were denied by SAFE at our request, and a limited agency, which we were granted. We were granted that in order for people that called up that didn't have an agent, we could service them, and we have people that can do that. Here's the numbers, which you've heard once before. From September 2004 to date, AOI has received $29.25 for our efforts in that respect. Not the $400,000 falsely insinuated by their assertion of our being granted limited agency status. $29.25. John DiLorenzo, in his testimony before this committee on Tuesday, employed a follow-the-money approach to implicate that SAFE is an unethical business practices with other business groups. He stated that because there are financial relationships between SAFE and groups who represent business, there is a reason for the legislature to dictate group plans, audits, RFPs, and financial activities of affiliated organizations. To be fair, we'd like to see this committee look at the business practices of the insurance company that is funding the groups that employ John DiLorenzo. The public record is replete with documents detailing unethical practices that these groups have employed in order to bring down SAFE. They are detailed in the tabs of the handout that's been distributed. Tab 1, for example. Oregonians for Accountability. It's a political action committee that handled Measure 38. Who is behind this most recent series of attacks on SAFE, and what do they have to gain? 99.99% of the contributions to the $5.6 million campaign to eliminate SAFE through the passage of Measure 38 came from Liberty Northwest Insurance. And that total doesn't include the $2 million spent to obtain the signatures to start with. Who charged over $29,000 to provide the legal advice to this pro-Major 38 group? John DiLorenzo's firm, Davis Wright Germain, tab 2. Oregonians for Sound Economic Policy, article for recognition of tax-exempt status, self-explanatory, tab 3. Oregonian article, insured puts $700,000 into Safe Fight on Oregonians for Sound Economic Policy and their financial backing by Liberty Northwest. Tab 4, Oregonian article, Safe Critic quits post under pressure. on the resignation of Chuck Sides, director of so-called Oregonians for Sound Economic Policy, due to unethical financial practices. Since the formation in 1997 as a tax-exempt 501c6 organization, the overwhelming majority of the funding for Oregonians for Sound Economic Policy came from Liberty Northwest to the tune of $758,000 over 6 years. Founding board members were Joe Gilliam, who incidentally is the husband of Lisa Gilliam, who ran the Pro Measure 38 campaign, Chuck Sides, a former Salem area legislator, and Portland attorney John DiLorenzo. In their application, it is explicitly stated that John DiLorenzo will be representing the entity regardless of what law firm he works at. Since 1997, this tax-sheltered money has paid John DiLorenzo, Chuck Sides, and other unnamed advisors over $630,000 for attorney fees and lobbying expenses. This money, in part, was improperly used and falsely reported to the IRS, forcing their director, Chuck Sides, to resign in shame. Nearly $70,000 was identified in loans to Chuck Sides that apparently were never repaid nor called into question by its own board of directors. We are aware of no civil action as yet to recover that debt. And John DiLorenzo is unashamed by this group's flagrant disregard for financial responsibility associated with being a tax-exempt organization. In his testimony Tuesday, cited them as the financiers of his firm's representation. Oregonians for Sound Economic Policy is a shell organization for Liberty Mutual Insurance and is being systematically used to try to cripple SAFE. Currently, their board is composed of one person, Sean Miller, who also happens to lobby for, you guessed it, Liberty Northwest. Tab 5. Text of Ballot Measure 38, Section 10C, detailing an unusual proscribed legal settlement of a lawsuit. Call that to your attention. Tab 6. Statesman Journal article, lawyer could hit personal jackpot with safe fight. An absolutely outrageous provision was written into Measure 38 in Section 10C of this Act, which was specifically written to settle an unnamed outstanding lawsuit. According to the Statesman Journal, the legal fees were not public record, but based on precedent, could have reaped up to $60 million in lawyer fees. $60 million. And who was the one that represented the one lawsuit that fits the description in Measure 38? Davis Wright Tremaine's John DiLorenzo. In fact, Mr. DiLorenzo told the reporter that without this get-rich-quick provision, he could not support the measure. Please remember how outraged John DiLorenzo was about what he claimed were sweetheart deals between safe and private businesses. Where is the outrage regarding Liberty Northwest practices to game Oregon politics by footing the bill for tax-exempt shell groups, high-priced lobbyists, and statewide ballot measures? Liberty Northwest Insurance is the financial proprietor behind Measure 38, Oregonians for Accountability PAC, Oregonians for Sound Economic Policy, Davis Wright Tremaine, and John DiLorenzo's legal representation. Liberty Northwest would stand to gain financially by toppling Oregon's workers' compensation program SAFE and gaining a bigger market share as a result. Measure 38 voting results. The people have spoken with a resounding 61%, 39% vote against Measure 38, which is a greater margin than many legislators enjoyed in their last election. This represents the most statistically correct poll available and clearly states there is not a public outcry to have more legislative oversight over SAFE. But the reforms that were started by Governor Kulongowski and have been put into practice by Miss Brenda Rockland have a chance to work. If you feel you'd like to pass a law that affects workers' compensation in Oregon and do something to stop out-of-state insurance corporations from attempting to buy the passage of an Oregon ballot measure that they would personally gain from, I would urge this committee to be focused its attention on several issues that state and local governments have purview over that would improve the lives of Oregonians rather than line the pockets of Liberty Northwest business partners. For example, you could be looking at efforts to create jobs, providing access to health care, helping needy families, controlling crime. Tab 8 is one little letter. We got thousands of them, hundreds.
Wait a minute. Mr. Buttrick, you're suggesting the committee is wasting time here in the middle of your testimony on page 7, or what are you doing here?
I do not feel personally that the bills that have been suggested are going to improve the Safe Corporation and improve worker safety and improve the cost of doing business with
Safe. Including Senate Bill 310?
Senate Bill 310 is a support because it basically, as I understand it, and Lisa can speak to this better than I, it basically puts Safe in exactly the same position every other state agency is in. Is that correct? So, we support that. They're doing away with the group programs. For example, Liberty Northwest has at least two I know of, but of course the bill I don't think addresses them. Just say. California, Mr. Chairman, I just learned just a couple days ago, have taken their enormous workers' comp fund, which is all state, and it's 10 times bigger than SAFE says, and they've gone to 200 group contracts based on our experience over the last 15 years, 20 years. Because it works. There's an affinity in associations for the members of an association.
Mr. Buttrick, I guess what I'm saying as I look at this on page 7 and so on, I didn't ask for this job, okay?
You didn't ask for
this job, this chairmanship of this committee to spend a year and a half of my life on SAFE, Liberty Northwest, and all kinds of other folks. I didn't have any expertise in the subject when I came, but I sure spent a lot of time on it. I didn't ask for the job. I got it. And what I sense in the middle of page 7 is that now you're telling us, you know, that we're wasting our time and I don't know. The testimony that I've listened to, I don't know how to say this, but we're spending too much time calling each other names here. I want to get on and do some work that I think Brenda Rockland wants to get done and Corey Streisinger and some other people. They might not like everything that we do as a committee, but we need to get past just yelling at one another and calling one another names. I guess that's what I'm trying to do. Maybe I'm at the lunch here or out to dinner at this point in the afternoon.
Now, Mr. Chairman, if I might respond to that.
Sure.
We didn't start Measure 38. We didn't last Tuesday, to bring us up to a day and a half ago, call each other names either. When somebody calls my name out,
right,
they're going to get a response.
Okay.
They call my association name out, okay, they're going to get a response because it directly affects the 23 people that work at AOI.
Okay. I understand that. I think you enjoy. You said something about appreciating the testimony of AGC a while ago. What I'm saying is they spent time talking about what they were doing. I imagine they made a few comments about being angered by what was said on Tuesday. I guess I'm asking you to spend your time and your testimony time, you know, speaking about what AOI is doing and defending AOI. Am I accurate?
Well, Mr.
Committee, am I missing something here?
Mr. Chairman, I did testify earlier, okay, sometime earlier, and I went through chapter and verse of what our program is about in some exquisite detail. So I didn't repeat it here. I'm happy to do that.
Okay.
I'm happy to repeat the history that we have. For example, part of the history, as you may recall, Mr. Chairman, is that in 1965, we're the ones that carried the three-way system and made it a three-way system. Before that, it was a two-way system. And so, ironically, without AOI, Liberty Northwest and all the other over 100 insurance companies that are in Oregon wouldn't be here. The same thing is true in 83, I believe, when SAFE was turned into a state entity. Not a state agency, but a state entity, like OHSU, like PORT, like those two I think of.
I guess
that was a good decision made by your predecessors. We supported it.
I guess what I'm complaining about, if I call it that, is I didn't say a word throughout your testimony, even though I felt like you and John DiLorenzo had exchanged your blows in front of my committee. I didn't say anything until I got to this page where you say that this committee could be focusing its attention on several issues, you know, that would improve the lives of Oregonians rather than lining the pockets of Liberty Northwest partners. That's not what I'm trying to do here in this testimony. And I was given a job by the President of the Senate to try and figure this thing out.
And you have my sympathy, Mr. Chairman.
Well, the problem is that they also gave me four committees and about a 14-hour workday and then said, oh, by the way, figure it out in your spare time.
Yes.
You know, and I'm going to start skipping a lot of those committees, I think, and try to become the expert that I ought to become on this issue. And it's going to take an awful lot of time and energy and a total rearrangement of my schedule.
Well,
just trying to do the job I've been doing.
I understand that, Mr. Chairman.
The committee is trying to do the same thing.
I appreciate that. And I do think, I will say this, if I may, and that is, there is a new sheriff in town, as was mentioned earlier. And her name is Ms. Rockland. And therefore, the legislative oversight, as Senator Starr mentioned, is now going to be part of our culture. Whereas before that, it wasn't. Therefore, your effort in respect to understanding a $400 million a year entity with 800 and some employees that covers 30 to 40,000 employers plus their employees is probably not time wasted.
Thank you for that comment. Senator Starr, did you have a comment?
Yes, I have a couple of questions, and they're basically the same questions that I asked Mr. Honeyman. Has the AGC had group contracts with any other workers' comp?
You mean AOI?
AOI, I'm sorry.
Yes, we did have a group contract with our retail association affiliate with Liberty Northwest. Until 1991, Senator. And we changed that because I got a call from the CEO of Liberty Northwest that said he was canceling the group because he wasn't interested in small groups, small members.
And then the next question, Mr. Chair,
yes.
The same one that I asked Mr. Honeyman, is two parts. Has your group agreement with SAFE been audited in the past, and do you have any concerns about it being audited going forward?
No, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman, Mr. Senator, I don't believe that our contracts have been formally audited by somebody coming over and auditing them. Have no problem with that happening. I've been asked before if I have a problem with that happening. The answer is absolutely no. I don't have a problem. I do know, though, that SAFE Corporation is audited to death by the Secretary of State and DCBS. It has outside actuaries looking at its numbers. It has a national association of auditors looking at it. So they're looked at all the time. But specifically as it relates to our specific contract, I don't recall that ever occurring. And that would be 15 years' worth.
Any other questions? Senator George, remember, we're running out of time.
I know, okay? And you tell me regularly that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm a little bit concerned. I have a lot of confidence in Brenda. I've seen what she's done, but she's also been moved from one place to another. Do you believe that in the past, all the conduct by SAFE, let's say particularly over the last 5 years, that conduct has been above board and would have been in totally in the public interest relative to its lobbying activities and that sort of thing?
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, I am not really privy to the internal operations of SAFE Corporation. I was aware that they had a contract with a private lobbyist. We had very little contact with him. I was aware they had a contract with a public relations firm. I had virtually no contact with them. I was aware that there was a contract of some unspecific contact with Goldschmidt, Imussen, and Carter. Virtually no contact with them. I don't know what it was. I read in the paper what it was after, you know, all came out. That's bad news. But we had no contact with that. Therefore, my relationship with the SAFE Corporation and its former president was cordial, straightforward, argumentative on occasion. I didn't get what I wanted all the time, which always annoys me. There was certainly due diligence done in our relationship. I did report to her concerns that I would have as it relates to the work we're supposed to be doing, and ask for advice and counsel from time to time. For example, our risk manager, we stole from SAFE about 3 years ago. Mina Hansen. So my answer to that, both past and present, would be no, I did not have personal concerns.
Okay, then I did have two questions. And the second one is, are you aware of the length of period? Because and maybe I should ask the question of her, but are you aware of any extended contract that she has? Because we're hanging everything. I mean, the last two organizations who have spoken have hung everything on the fact that we must trust Brenda. And I do that. But I'm afraid that when the new sheriff leaves town, the bad guys may have reoccupied. And that's why we have these bills before us that's going to try to get some clarity, some accountability, some openness, and some fairness. Because this is a government entity.
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, I heard that argument, I believe, from Mr. DiLorenzo. What if Brenda leaves? We trust Brenda. She said she's going to do something. She'll do it. But what if she leaves? And I guess my answer to that would be, really, it's the governor's responsibility to put people into the board of SAFE. There's only three of them now. It should be five. Hopefully, he'll act on that. That is approved by the Senate Rules Committee, and that will carry the day. That's about as good as you can do with anything in government, I would think.
Mr. Buttrick, I want to thank you for your time this afternoon. I want to try and get Jim Geisinger up here. If he goes as long as the previous two, we're here for a while.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Thank you. Jim comes from Oregon Loggers, right?
Right.
Thank you very much, sir, for your time this evening.
If you don't mind, I think I'll use this microphone. I think that one's on the verge of melting.
Mr. Chairman, you know, we asked Mr. DiLorenzo before to come back in because we kind of felt it was like loading up on, you know, one side. Why not have Mr. DiLorenzo come up to that other mic and give an opportunity to maybe balance this a little bit because we're one-sided.
The other day, I gave everybody some time to cool off. There was no response.
They're not cool.
Well, I'm saying I think it's fair to say that the other day there were several people in a room who immediately wanted to jump to a microphone. They immediately wanted to take on Mr. DiLorenzo. I did not allow that. Mm-hmm. I wanted everybody to cool down.
Right.
We're going to be in these hearings. John's going to have a chance to come back. He can rebut. I don't want to escalate this into this is not a boxing match that I'm running here.
Mr. Chairman, I'm disturbed, though. At the bottom of page 7, an Associate Oregon Industries testimony, it says, SafeWorks, stop allowing Liberty Northwest and its hired guns to dictate your committee's agenda.
Well, that was, I think, more of an insult to us, this committee, than it was to John, who I respect, and he's done a very good job.
So it's a good hired gun.
Well, you know, that used to be a real mark of manhood in this old West of ours, so let's hear
Mr.
from this.
Mr. Chairman, one. Members of the committee, my name is Jim Geisinger. I represent Associated Oregon Loggers. I think I can stand your good graces this evening and cut this very, very short because my testimony is about 99.9% congruent with Craig Honeyman's. The only comment that he made that I might take exception to is that AGC has the best loss control system in the state of Oregon.
Might be second best to yours is what you're saying.
Correct.
I see.
Maybe, a close second probably, but Mr. Chairman, I was not here on Tuesday to hear Mr. DiLorenzo. I watch the agendas I get electronically very, very religiously, and I never did see him scheduled to testify, so I was out of town.
My apologies, he was scheduled on an agenda, though it showed up but had a date of the 21st, and then we dropped it, and then we put it back. That was my fault. I screwed up on that.
That's fine. I just wanted to know I didn't have the benefit of listening to his testimony. I have heard quite a bit about it. And I would just like to comment specifically on the provisions of Senate Bill 986. As Jessica said, our interpretation of that bill is it essentially would eliminate groups because it would remove a requirement for a company to be a member of an association in order to be into that association's group plan. And that effectively eliminates the need or any reason why an association would want to have a plan. At Associated Oregon Loggers, we have 4 full-time loss control consultants that have been professional loggers earlier in their career. We're going to hire a 5th one this summer. These guys are out in the field every day helping our members learn how to work more safely. We have what they do ranges from holding training sessions for crew members, performing site safety inspections, helping companies preparing employee safety handbooks, and keeping up with required book paperwork. We have a full-time safety training director who produces videos and pamphlets and magazine articles for our members to utilize in training their crews. We also have a full-time return-to-work specialist, and we're going to hire a 2nd one of those this summer. And what his job is to make sure that when someone does get injured, they get back to meaningful employment as quickly as possible. The members of this group are also enrolled in our Oregon Professional Logger Program. This is a professional accreditation and continuing education program for loggers. It requires classroom training and field training to help members perform in a professional and safe manner. And finally, we have an insurance manager that we too hired away from SAFE who is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to help our members with whatever insurance needs they have. And I can assure you that the cost of providing these services for our members greatly exceeds whatever compensation we get from the SAFE Corporation. Wish we got more, but safety is expensive, and we are in the business of trying to provide a safer workplace for our members and their employees as possible. And with all due respect to the tremendous capabilities of SAFE, we think we can provide this loss control service more efficiently and more effectively than they could if they were required to provide the services directly as an insurance company. We have the expertise. We have professional loggers on the staff that understand the needs, the daily needs of our members, and we think they can deliver that in a more effective way. So if you took away the requirement that our association has today that you have to be a member in order to be a part of the group, that effectively would eliminate the reason to have the group. And if I read Senate Bill 986 correctly, if the guy that owns the gas station next to our office wanted to be in our group, he could come in our group, even though it's specifically designed for contract loggers and the special needs that they have. The only additional comment I would like to make is that our members, 99% of whom are insured by SAFE, truly feel that SAFE is the only place that's available for worker comp insurance for our industry. And I'd like to offer an example of our concern for the record that just occurred last year with one of our members that happens to be a member of the Warm Springs Tribe. Bruce Bruno Logging was canceled last May by Liberty Northwest for no other reason then his premium was a paltry $14,000. He got a letter from Liberty saying, we're not canceling you because you didn't have a good safety record, but we just have some new underwriting guidelines, and you're not a reflection, and this is not a reflection of your company's claims history. And closed with it was an internal memo from a couple of Liberty employees, happened to be a senior account executive and a senior underwriter. The account executive said, please consider the following. This account has had one claim for $383 since September 1998. Now, that's a phenomenal safety record in our industry. They have been our policyholder since July 1992. They've been with them for a dozen years. The Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs are a very tight-knit group. This will not be a politically sensitive decision. The response was, the experience for this account has been reviewed. The information has been obtained through this review indicates the need to recommend non-renewal for this account. See reasons below. And these were the reasons. As discussed at last renewal, this account has logging and mechanized logging exposure as well as a log truck. And if premium wasn't substantially up over this current year, we would need to non-renew. Way too much exposure for this very small premium size. Logging minimum premium is now up to $100,000, and mechanized logging minimum is $50,000. Current year has $10,900 premium, and last year's premium was $7,674, and the year before that, $9,096. Time to get off before we get the really big loss. And that's the alternative that our members have if SAFE was not available to them. This company is now insured by SAFE. SAFE came in and wrote him a policy, even though he was small. Now, for those of you not familiar with the logging industry, to have a $100,000 premium on a conventional logging side, you have to have $500,000, $600,000, or $700,000 of payroll. Those companies are in the top 10% of our membership. 90% of them are smaller than that. So when people are critical about us investing in the preservation of SAFE, it's because we need SAFE. It is a life or death situation for the future of the vast majority of our members, and I would hope that you would consider that, and I would encourage you to pass Senate Bill 310. It addresses all the substantive concerns that I've heard in the 5 years that I've been associated with AOL. I think it would be a good step in the right direction to increase transparency. To answer the question that's been asked here several times a day, I think the previous administration at SAFE may have had some problems, but I think a lot of the accusations were strictly manufactured by some pretty smart legal minds. And I don't know that I agree that the corruption that's been described in that organization was anywhere near the severity that's been described here today and in previous hearings. And with that, Mr. Chairman, if there are any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Well, I do appreciate the brevity of your testimony. Thank you.
Mr. Honeyman did a very nice job of what I wanted to say.
You have a question?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask Mr. Geisinger basically the same questions I asked Mr. Buttrick and Mr. Honeyman regarding audits. Has your agreement with SAFE ever been audited, and do you have any reason not to want the agreement?
There is a clause in our contract that says they're free to audit us at any time. I have to plead some ignorance. I do not know that I know we haven't been subject to an audit since we renewed our contract. Like, I do know that. Prior to that, I simply don't know, but I'd be happy to find that that information for you. I do know that they can come in and audit our contract whenever they want.
Mr. Chair, may I make one quick comment?
Yes.
Yes. Thank you very much. I'd like to respond to your last comment. I have no idea of whether it was corrupt or whether it was not. I've not been able to talk to the people who were there.
I would like to close the hearing on all of these SAFE bills that we're having right now. And I don't know how to do this. Are all the people that were sitting around waiting for Senate Bill 511 still sitting here?
Stand up.
Please come forward. I'm worn out. I may fall asleep. Well, come on in. Come up. I want to do this very quickly. In fact, I may give this to my vice chair, Senator George, to do.
Hey, I was just going to go ask somebody a question.
You can't. You got to care.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Julie Brandis with
Let's keep the noise down in here. I got another hearing going on in Senate Bill 511.
I'm Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries, the rest of the team, and I'm here today in opposition to Senate Bill 511. I have spoken with Senator Deckard about this bill today. Just really, we obviously do not oppose the idea of finding ways to support low-income homeowners and rental people providing energy for their homes. The problem is it goes back to opening up a very important piece of legislation, the energy, well, the Public Purpose Trust Fund that was part of energy restructuring. We're very sensitive to that. Our members are, when I talk to our energy managers and the major companies that we represent, this is something they are very sensitive to. The bill is, the legislation by statute is required to be open next session, and for sort of a shifting to occur, to take a look at the priorities of the original act. And that is important, and we'd like to keep to that agreement that was made originally. So that's the reason for our opposition, and I thank you for seeing me so I can go home to my family.
Thank you. Ozzie, would you like to make a quick comment as well?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, member of the committee for record, I'm Ozzie Rose. I am representing the Oregon Association of ESDs, and I've handed a little handout there. As you know, the ESDs are managing these projects in local school districts, so this is really a local school district issue in terms of my testimony. The local school districts have had audits, and they've entered into contracts to do things to their buildings to reduce energy costs. And what I've shared with you it's out of the ESD here. They manage 60-some school districts around the state. 10 ESDs have asked them to do it. And our issue is that we have entered into long-term debt. When we got the audits done, we did some work. We entered into long-term debt, and we are expecting to pay for that debt out of these monies. If you jerk the monies on us now, and there are 10 or 12 examples here, and it's a substantial amount of money that's been committed on the assumption that this was going to continue to flow and pay off these debts. Most of them are over the next 8 years, and that's all I have to say.
Okay. I don't take my body language as meaning that I'm not interested in the bill, because I've heard these arguments, opening it as one and the ongoing commitments as another. I'm just at the phase of gathering information about this. As I said, I would for Senator Decker. I don't know where this is going to go. I also think that there's a compelling concern about the very poor that we heard from earlier today. I want to receive other testimony if there's some other people here to do that. Jeff, are you the only other one?
I don't know.
Anybody else other than Jeff? Good. Two or three people that wanted to testify left. I'll let you have the same 2 minutes right now as I gave them, and then we're out of here. Is that okay? That way I don't have to just get Gimpy over here with his bad leg to come over and chair the committee. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnette with the Fair and Clean Energy Coalition, and we have no argument with what Senate Bill 511 intends to do. We do recognize the need. We were the public interest coalition that was negotiated both the public purposes and the low-income parts of Senate Bill 1149. Our difficulty with Senate Bill 511 is twofold. One is that it pits low-income people against schools, which is not something that we'd care to do. It also mixes two separate funds that were specifically designed for different purposes, and we did that originally because our observation in other states was that people that we usually were allies, energy conservation folks, renewable energy folks, low-income advocates, consumer advocates, fought over money continually, and so we kept it separate. What we'd like to do is to acknowledge the ultimate goal of Senate Bill 511 and acknowledge that there is more need for low-income bill payment assistance, and suggest that either this committee or some other committee, through a different vehicle, either Senate Bill 81 or Senate Bill 408, because they both relate to rates of public utilities. Unfortunately, they're not in this committee. And focus on the part of the statute of the low-income bill payment assistance and simply raise that. And let the schools do what the schools are doing. Senator Deckard actually doesn't take enough credit for both getting audits done and providing the money to implement the audits, because that is what actually gets the energy savings and the money savings. And what we need to do is go after more low income. And I'm happy to come back and talk to the committee more about that proposal and how a different way to go about this same goal.
I would like to ask you guys to be in conversation with Senator Deckard. I'm not sure that there can't be some compromise, i.e., money that could fulfill the obligations that are there, some money broke off, maybe potentially to address the other thing. I've talked to him about that. I'd like you to talk to him about it. As far as Julie is concerned, opening this thing up, if anybody messed with what we did on the Senate side, there'd have to be a concurrence, and I wouldn't concur, and we'd shut the whole operation down. That's the worst-case scenario. So it would insure against that thing that people fear.
Mr. Chair, could I get some clarification?
Sure.
When the legislature divided the money, they divided it five ways from the public purposes contribution. 10% of the money goes for energy conservation in schools, period. So actually, you're not allowed to use that funds for anything other than energy conservation. What does that include besides audits?
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, the document here spells out in a handful of districts what the kinds of things, but it's improving your HVAC systems, it's doing stuff with your lights, all the things that will save, what the audit tells you will save energy. Then they turn around and build a project to do that. Okay. And if you, there are some.
But the funds are not used for the project itself. The funds are used for the project itself. That's what I'm asking.
I believe the answer is yes to that question, the way you're asking.
The answer is yes.
Yes.
The answer is yes.
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 And that falls within the parameters.
Yes.
The energy trust gets about $50 million a year. So we're not talking about a small amount of money here.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, the portion that goes to the schools for the audits, which are pretty much done, and then to support the projects that kind of are derived from the audits that are recommended in the audits, is about $5 to $6 million a year. That's the amount of the public purpose chunk that's going to the schools. And that's the amount that we're talking about potentially diverting. And what we're saying, don't divert it. Let it go to the schools. Let it do the work that it was intended to do. And let's figure out another way to get about $5 million to low-income bill payment assistance.
Okay. I'm in no way trying to say that anything about 511.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm trying to determine is whether this amount of money is completed with what its intent was to be to the schools, as what Senator Deckard's bill seems to say, is that the audits have been done. And so now it would be better to shift it to the low income, the energy for low-income families, sorry, the heat for low-income families. So I'm trying to determine. I'm looking at a list of what the legislature said. I can go back and look closer as to what the parameters are. But if right now what I'm reading, it says it's for energy conservation in schools. And so it shouldn't be used for anything else. That doesn't mean that if it said solar panels would be great in certain areas that you couldn't use the money to buy the solar panels. That's what I'm trying to figure out, is where.
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, the energy conservation, it was for energy audits and energy conservation projects that were identified through the audits. An audit does not save money. It does not produce energy savings. Actually, implementing the recommendations from the audit is what saves the money. And so the answer to your question is the money was intended to support the audits and the process to complete the audits, and then to implement the audit over the course of the 10-year lifespan of the public purpose fund.
And the ESDs, in cooperation with the Oregon Energy Department, are the ones that oversee it, right?
That's correct.
All right. All right. Thank you very much.
Senator Berger, let me ask a question. Help me clarify, and maybe it will help you, too. Ozzie, we haven't completed all the schools. I'm looking at this thing, and we're doing things like, you know, removing the PCB ballast that may be present in the school. We all know how dangerous that is. Adding digital control to make sure we shut down systems like water heaters and that sort of thing. Have we completed all of these needs in so many of our older buildings that really do need energy help?
Madam Chair, Senator George, the answer is no. For example, in Portland, they have got about 60% of their buildings, the audits complete, and they've started projects on. They got another 40% to go. I can't tell you those kind of numbers statewide, but no, we're nowhere near getting it all done.
And we haven't funded all those projects that they have remaining.
No.
Okay.
And there are other things. Some are doing things without this kind of funding because it needs to be done. But our concern is we started on a path with this funding, made commitments, and if you jerk the funding on, that's a problem.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, just very quickly, I was reminded that it's always good to underscore that the public purpose dollars are, you know, only collected and spent in the service territories of Portland General Electric and PacifiCorp.
Right. And the dollars collected must be spent in the school districts that are in that service area.
That's correct.
Anything further? Committee, is there anyone else that wanted to speak to Senate Bill 511?
Mr. Senator George, I apologize for my remark. Madam Chair, Senator George, I probably misconstrued who's running this meeting. I apologize.
That's all right. We can talk to that other side, too. All right. At this time, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 511. If there's nothing further to come before the committee, we'll be adjourned. And thank you for remaining.